welcome to Hype, episode 105. My name is Selena. I'm back to make bad jokes this week with Pam and Kristen, whose jokes will probably not be as bad, but we'll find out. This will be very exciting. I know I was on an episode of Hype regularly a couple of weeks ago, but I haven't been on an episode with Kristen in like a month and a half or something like that.
It's been a while, that's for sure. I've been gone for a couple of weeks.
Yeah,
so.
And I haven't even been on Rewatchable with you. Like, it's just been... It's been
weird.
I know. So this is exciting. I'm very happy to be back. And we have a lot of stories to get into this week. There's some Pottermore stuff. There's some Star Wars and Star Trek and Tetris. You know, the big three, obviously, that everyone cares about. There's Gilmore Girls and Game of Thrones and all this stuff. So we will be getting into talking about all of that. But before we do anything, I want to give you the contact information so you know how to contact us if you have a comment on this episode or anything you would like us to talk about in the future. You can find us on Hypable, which is hypable.com, hypable.com. You can find us on Twitter at hypablehype. You can find us on Tumblr, hypepodcast.tumblr.com. And if you want to email us, you can do that hype@hypable.com. We also have a couple of specials that hopefully if you're subscribed to us on iTunes, you'll get them all into your feed, and we highly recommend that. We have a couple of Cursed Child specials because a couple of the hosts went to see it in London earlier this month, and we have one that's completely spoiler-free, tested by the listeners, so we know it's safe, and we have one that's a plot discussion for those of you who've either seen the play and want to discuss it with someone or who want to know, like, a first-hand account of what happened instead of reading spoilers. You can find all that. We also have an interview with Misha Collins of Supernatural and Gishwish. And I believe, Pam, we have a full team now of scavenger hunters.
We do. I'm so pleasantly surprised.
So surprised.
Yeah, and I was really sad because we had to turn people away, like, not to say that we're like, oh, we're so popular, but we did get a huge bump when Misha tweeted about it, and yeah, we're all full, but we're excited to play with everybody that signed up with us for sure.
Yes. Oh, the dog. Okay, so moving into How We Hype, which is where we tell you what we've been doing in fandom this past week. Kristen, why don't we start with you?
Sure. So I've been reviewing movies for Hypable this summer, and it's been really, really fun so far. And last week, I got to see Independence Day Resurgence, and I have to say, while I've seen a lot of really mean reviews, if you like Independence Day, you will like this movie. Like, it makes me sad that critics felt it necessary to, like, beat it up and, like, really just trash it, but it's a really fun movie, and there's enough little, like, throwbacks to Independence Day that it's a really good time, and, like, Liam Hemsworth is really funny, and, I mean, Jeff Goldblum is just awesome in general all the time, and so, yeah, if you like Independence Day, you will love Independence Day Resurgence. It was good fun.
That's good to hear. I always like when we can sort of offer some alternative opinions. I feel like there are these movies that just get unfairly, like, massively slaughtered, and others get, like, hyped up by everyone, and it's such a weird thing because you see it and you're like,
Yeah, like, I'm not concerned with the plot of Independence Day being seamless and having no, like when you have a movie like that, the first one had some major holes, like, you know, things where you could be like, guys, come on, like, there's no way that happens and we miss it or blah, 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 blah. So, I mean, if you're looking for a seamless, perfect sci-fi movie, you're not going to find that in Independence Day, but okay, it's a good time and it's really entertaining. So that's, you know, sometimes that's all you need.
That's awesome. Pam, is your dog still barking?
No, I knew this was going to happen. Somebody came home and I told them to come before we started, but they didn't listen. So it's okay. Yeah, he's done. Yeah. Okay. So I, a couple of weeks ago, I've been dying to talk about this, you guys. I saw Swiss Army Man, which is, of course, the Dan Radcliffe farting movie that also stars Paul Dano. I think that the flatulence was like the center of attention when this movie premiered at Sundance, but it's like this movie is so much more than that. And I know that there were some reports of people like walking out, and I just like, it's their loss, because it is one of the most original movies that I've seen like this year. It's so wonderful. The story is so great. It's hilarious. It's touching. It's like everything you would basically like want in a movie. And like, yeah, there's like farting, but it's like it's totally like secondary to like everything
Love
else
that
that
you
goes
have
on
to
this movie.
address that. It's like, yeah.
Yeah, because it's like that's the thing. I feel like everybody's like, this looks really stupid, but I hope that everybody has seen the trailer that premiered a couple of weeks ago by now. And if you haven't, I highly recommend going to check it out, because at the end of the day, this is just a story about two men that happen to be thrown in an unbelievable situation together, and they bond and they learn from each other. And it's just such a beautiful story. And some of the things that happen, like, you really don't see coming. And it's very much like, you know, like Manny, who's Dan Radcliffe's character, he's kind of like learning how to be a human again, because he, you know, he's dead. And so he doesn't remember a lot of things, like what it means to love or what it means to feel certain things. And Paul Dano is also like really down on his luck, because he's been stranded on his own for so long that he's kind of forgotten how to be human too. So it's just such a beautiful movie, and I highly recommend going to see it. It does wide release this Friday, July 1st here in America. I'm not sure about the release dates worldwide, but I'm sure it'll be coming out to a town near you. And I highly recommend going to check it out, because I was ridiculously floored by it in general. And I really enjoyed it a lot.
That's awesome. That's really good to hear. So I don't really have anything this week. I just wanted to say that I finished The Rest of Us Just Live Here. I got confused by my own acronym.
I was trying to phonetically say this, and I was
Anyway, The Trujure is really good. It was recommended to me by Merrima. Patrick Ness is going to be... Troughton. I got my words all mixed up today. He's going to be doing the new Doctor Who spin-off Class, and I wanted to check out some of the stuff he's done. It's very cute. I would say it's funny, because I don't think Patrick Ness is American, but it is very American. Like, it's a very American young adult book. But that's not to say it's a bad thing. It's just kind of the overall feel of it. But it's sort of very cute. It pokes a little bit fun at the superhero archetype narrative, which is happening in the background while we follow a group of people doing other stuff. And I feel like it's Buffy happening in the background, so I'm like a little bit sort of like, oh, how dare you? But I also like it, so it's fine. It's really fun. I definitely recommend you check that out if you're preparing yourself for Class and want to see what Patrick Ness has done. So, oh, speaking of Buffy, I guess I'll just say I watched the finale of season 3, and I didn't get to talk about it on the podcast, Rewatchable, but I wanted to talk about it here because it's so good and I love it so much. And it's one of, I don't know if you remember it, Pam, but it's one of those episodes that just always strikes me as such a, like... You know, I get that feeling in my stomach, like, oh my god, it's so epic and it's so amazing, and I love these characters so much. And I was very sad I didn't get to talk about it.
I will say, watching it for the first time, that 2-part finale felt more like movie-ish than any other episodes of Buffy I've seen so far. Like, it just felt grander and bigger. Like, as I was watching it, I was like, wow, like, this just feels like movie-esque, not just, oh, hey, this is our, you know, finale and ta-da, you know, this season's done. Like, it felt bigger for some reason, but I really, really liked it, so yay. I understand.
I recommend Buffy this week. So moving into the news now, we have a lot to talk about, and we're going to start with probably, you know, most relevant to our and our listeners' interests, which is Pottermore stuff. We had a big release earlier this week when J.K. Rowling wrote a lengthy backstory for Ilvermorny, the American Hogwarts, basically, and we also got a sorting quiz for, like, giving you your Ilvermorny house. And obviously this is all to tie into the Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them movie that's coming out in November. So we're just sort of learning more about the American wizarding world because the story is set there. So first of all, I want to know if you guys have read the whole story. What did you think of it? And if you haven't, start reading now, because it's so good.
Yes, I loved it a lot more than I thought I was going to.
Yeah.
It like completely sucked me in, and I wanted more, and it was great. It just had like that, I just like that magical feeling that you wish all the pieces that she writes would have. It just reminded me so much of that, you know, like wanting to like jump into Harry's world and like never come out. Like when she started weaving this whole tale, like that's how I felt. So that was really nice.
I read the Hypeable article, but I don't think I went through and read the whole thing. So I will have to dive in and read the entire JK written thing. But yeah, I liked what I read so far. So
yeah, I mean, there's so many things to love about it. And obviously, unfortunately, we don't have time to really pick it apart. But what I really love is, first of all, it's obviously this girl lead character, you might say, called Isolde, who has this really tragic backstory, who goes to America and who sort of makes her way through sort of the, it's basically this piece of wilderness where she only interacts with magical beasts, which is really cool and sort of has a little bit of tinge of one of the stories I was reading about this girl making her way through, like in ancient times, through an uninhabited section of the world and interacting with the wildlife there. And it's very evocative. It's amazing. She meets all these characters. She meets the Pukwudgie, who is like her companion and friend. And she adopts some boys and she meets a muggle and they all set up Ilvermorny together. And it explains too why there's so many similarities between Ilvermorny and Hogwarts. It's because she basically made the school for the two boys because they said, they always, like, she told them stories of Hogwarts and they always wanted to go. And she turns out, obviously, she's a descendant of Salazar Slytherin. And just the way they, J.K. Rowling weaves that into the story and sort of shows a different aspect of that house. Like, she's a Gaunt, right? Or her aunt is a Gaunt. That was funny to me. I'm sorry. I get amused by stupid things. There's so much about this that's, and it turns out she had Slytherin's wand for a long time without realizing. And it's just all that, the way it ties into the lore, this is a connection to Terry Boot, one of Harry's classmates at Hogwarts. That's perfect. Like, everything about it is so perfect. And like the only regret, you know, it's like you see this, you want more, is that why is this not a story? Why is this not the play? One might be tempted to ask. It expands the world, it doesn't limit it, which is amazing. Obviously, one of the big things that we learned here is we learned about the Ilvermorny sorting process and the four houses that sort of divide the students. So first of all, the sorting process is super interesting. She explains when new students arrive at Ilvermorny, which is described as this much more democratic and like free-spirited place than Hogwarts, they're taken to the entrance hall and they're called to stand in front of the Gordian knot with the four house symbols, and then statues around the room will claim the students. So the horned serpent will, like, the crystal in its forehead will light up, and the wampus will roar, and the thunderbird will beat its wings, and the Pukwudgie will raise its arrow into the air. And then sometimes more than one house claims a student and they can choose, and like only a few times has all four houses claimed the student. And actually one of them was Serafina something, who is the minister for magic when, or president of magic, whatever they call it, when Newt arrives in New York, actually was chosen by four houses. So that's sort of one of those really cool comparisons. The four houses are the Horned Serpent, which represents the mind and attracts scholars. There's the Wampus, the body, which attracts warriors. There's Pukwudgie, the heart, which attracts healers. And there's Thunderbird, the soul, which attracts adventurers. So first of all, I want to know, you guys took the quiz. What did you get? Let's talk about it.
I'm a Thunderbird.
Okay.
And I don't agree.
Okay.
Well, I've had a bit of an identity crisis. I've been a Ravenclaw, like, all my life. Mm-hmm. The whole time I've always known I'm a Ravenclaw, duh. Well, the last time I got sorted by Pottermore, the revamped quiz, I got Slytherin.
Oh.
Which, wow. I am the least Slytherin person to ever Slytherin. Like, well, seriously.
Here's the thing, Kristen. Sorry. I feel like I do
Who
that all
are
the time.
You?
Here's the thing, Kristen. I tell people this all the time. There's a lot more overlap between Ravenclaws and Slytherins than people, like, usually choose to believe.
Yeah.
So,
which I can totally see.
So I just could, know. Like, I think it would be weirder if you were like something completely opposite. At least you're kind of going along the same veins as a Ravenclaw, you know?
Right. Right. No, like I can see the overlap. I've just never identified with Slytherin. So when people like I took the quiz before I really knew what house stood for what. So I really didn't know. And then I looked at the article and read through it and was like, attracts adventurers. And I was like, I'm kind of an adventurer, but not really. Like, it's not my defining trait. So it's a little bit interesting. The whole soul thing part of it kind of makes some sense to me. Like, I've always kind of felt like more than, you know, wisdom or whatever, like I think the soul is something really important and all that. So like that I kind of get, but without more backstory or like a greater pool of people to see the qualities of each of these houses like kind of represented, it's hard to know exactly what each one means, you know?
I mean, yeah. And I think we'll also get into this a little bit more. I just want to say here, I also felt like this was a very short quiz. Like, I feel like I only had like 5 or 6 questions in mind, which was like, well, how can you determine anything based on that? You know, I didn't feel, and some of the questions I didn't understand. Like, there was one, I posted that on Twitter too, which was like, I am strongest when, and then the answer was awake. And I was like, what? How? What?
Okay, well, here's the funny thing, Selena, I didn't have that question.
No, I think maybe they took that away.
Neither did I.
Well, I feel like also, depending on how you were answering, like, the path to your house might have been shorter if you just answered...
Yeah, but like the
it a lot of
like,
the same ones.
I am strongest when awake. Like, what does that mean?
I mean, I guess if you want to, I don't know. I guess a Ravenclaw would think more deeply into that. It's like, yes, I'm awake, so I would be stronger because I would have the capability of all of my abilities, you know. But most but people would be like you. Exactly. Then you would say like, yeah, I'm strongest when I'm sleeping because I have the ability to open my mind further.
Maybe. But it doesn't even make grammatical sense, okay?
That's true. So what did you get?
Well, I got Pugwudgy, which is fine with me, because I'm always, like, I always get Gryffindor in quizzes, but I always feel like I'm, the older, we talked about this before, the older I get, the more mellow I become, and the more Hufflepuffy I become, and I sort of very strongly equate the Pugwudgy to a Hufflepuff. So I feel like, It's a compassionate house. It's the house of the heart. I feel like how can you not be okay with that? So I'm good. I'm good here. What did you get, Pam?
I got the Wampus.
Wampus? Yeah.
The warrior. Yeah, which is like, is it really? Does that really define me? Maybe. I don't know.
It does.
But not for myself. See, I'm never a warrior when it comes to my own gain. I just like I warrior for other people.
Yeah.
Isn't that funny?
Yeah.
So I guess like I have to be fine with it because I'm fairly Gryffindor-y in general. Like I'm 70-30 Gryffindor for the most part.
Yeah.
So I would have to be fine with Wampus because regardless of what Joe says, there is some overlap in the tiny minute details of traits that she chose to give out for these houses. So.
Oh, of course there is. And that's another thing we need to get into too, which is obviously the first thing everyone asks when they got their Ilvermorny sorting was, what does this mean for my Hogwarts house? If I'm a Thunderbird, can I still be a Ravenclaw, for example, is a question that people were asking. and a few things, like Andrew asked someone to make an article sort of explaining how they connected, and I did, and as I was putting my finishing touches on it, J.K. Rowling released a tweet, because she's personally out to get me at this point. She said, there's no equivalence between Hogwarts and Ilvermorny.
I must take down Selena.
I know.
I will do it.
So first of all, I mean, she says there's no equivalence, which it's not really true. I mean, it's true in the sense that I'm sure that just because you get one house doesn't mean you can't get another house, which is what happened to Kristen, which is what happens to a lot of people. But I feel like that is explained by what Pam said, which is that, well, first of all, I think the quiz, Ilvermorny quiz, at least when I took it, it was really stupid, so I don't really trust it anyway. But anyway, I feel like that's the thing. We did a whole thing on Hypeable, which has been super popular, the hybrid Hogwarts quiz, where you got like the two houses that define you. And I always felt like that was a lot more accurate than just putting yourself in one house, because I feel like most people, when they go beyond, like beneath the, like, oh, I want to be a whatever. Like, they always have one house and one supplementing house, you know? Like, I would say mine have always been Gryffindor and Hufflepuff. The difference is the balance between them. And Kristen, might, you might be a Ravenclaw and a Gryffindor or a Hufflepuff or whatever you feel. Like, you know, you have, like, one main house, and then you have one where you go, okay, well, I could always also go there because I'm also this and this and this. You know, when you take the traits on Harry Potter and you compare them to the people that are in those houses, there's so much overlap there, where under different circumstances, these characters, or when they're older, might belong to different houses than when they were first sorted. Does that make sense?
Totally, yeah. And I feel like, yeah, like, specifically with characters like Peter Pettigrew, for example, I feel like, like, that's a good example of somebody that probably started off, like, definitely had, like, Gryffindor and, like, maybe, like, I don't know, maybe, like, some other undertones, and then completely switched over because, like, the loyalty wasn't there anymore. So, you know, people, like, lose traits and they gain traits as they get older. And I think that that's what I really liked about this Ilvermorny, like, the idea of the Ilvermorny sorting, because I feel like I could see more often than not more than one house wanting a student. And I think that the fact that they put so much stock in, and not necessarily just saying, you have to be this, which is what the sorting hat says, and therefore, like, defines how that person sees themselves, like, to let these, like, for the possibility that these kids have to potentially choose, like, what traits they value most and what they might want to accentuate as they, like, go through their schooling is very interesting to me.
And also, you do get that in Hogwarts, too. Go on.
Yeah, well, I was gonna say it's a public choice. Like, Harry chose Gryffindor over Slytherin, but it was a private thing between him and the hat. Like, nobody else knew. Whereas with Ilvermorny, everybody is watching you choose your house. Like, I'm assuming, or, like, everyone knows that you were choosing to be in this place or that one, you know? So it's a little different.
I just kind of wonder, like, to me, when I was reading, and maybe this is just, like, being naive, like, I just wouldn't see that many kids, like, so vehemently telling the sorting hat that they'd like to be somewhere. So I because, like, because you grow up thinking, like, I'm gonna go to Hogwarts and the sorting hat's gonna tell me where I need to go. I don't need to question this, you know? So I don't know. It just, like, I well, just wonder how much stock that would play in the whole thing.
You know what I think makes a big difference is that J.K. Rowling said that Ilvermorny is a lot more, like, sort of accepting place than Hogwarts. Hogwarts is obviously, I touched on this in my article too, that there are definite, like, stereotypes connected to each house, and when, especially for Slytherins, but I also feel like for Hufflepuffs and Ravenclaws and Gryffindors to a lesser extent, but it's still there, that you feel like if you're in that house, you have all the pressure to live up to a particular image someone has of what a Slytherin is or what a Gryffindor is, etc. And Ilvermorny, and this is something that someone brought up somewhere on Facebook or Twitter or somewhere, Ilvermorny is almost more like, rather than having specific traits that you identify with a house, it's a whole sort of how you are as a being, you know, the whole thing of the Wampus, you are, it's the body, it's the physical, you act, you know, you fight, not like fist fight, but, you know, you express yourself with your physical being, you feel things physically. When you're a Thunderbird, it's like, it's internal, it's your internal life, you internalize things a lot. When you are a the Horned Serpent, it's your mind, you think things, you critically analyze them. That's why there's so much overlap too, just like with Slytherin and Ravenclaw, you know, like, they have their internal, both of them too, whereas Hufflepuff and Gryffindor are probably more like instinctual, you know.
And to me, it also kind of sounds like comparing it to a body. Like, in order for a body to work, you need all parts to be there. It almost kind of ingrains this idea of unity. Like, we are stronger as one, like, united we stand, divided we fall, and stuff like that. And that would make a lot of sense because, like, there's a lot of, like, overlap here in terms of, like, American history too. Like, when I was reading about like Ilvermorny of today, she mentions that the robes are navy and cranberry, which is, like, meant to represent Isolde and James's, like, favorite colors, but it's also like similar to the colors of, like, Revolutionary War uniforms and things like that. So it's like, it's just very interesting what she chose to kind of toss in there.
So anyway, like, I did make a comparison on Hyperbole. I stand by it. I mean, we've had some mixed feedback on it because some people are, like, dead set on the houses not correlating, but I'm sorry, they do. You know, like, they don't, it doesn't mean you can't be one and another, but I feel like the traits, they definitely, they complement each other.
No, I feel like when you're dividing people into houses or into groups like these two, like you know, institutions groups. Are, there's only so many ways you can define them. So there's going to be overlap. Like you're going to try to figure out which houses match up the best. Like if you are a Ravenclaw, which one seems the most Ravenclaw-ish? Clearly it's the Horned Serpent. Like it's just one of those things. There's going to be overlap. So whether she says they do or not, it's just natural that, yeah, they're going to have some.
Exactly, exactly. So yeah, so we figured it out. And it's very, very obvious. But it was still fun to sort of work out the psychology behind it. And I think the new Ilvermorny houses can sort of bring out a new side of the Hogwarts houses, which I think is cool. So Horned Serpent with the jewel in its forehead and the mind and favor scholars is Ravenclaw. Wampus is Gryffindor. It's the body, it's the warrior, the fact that the Wampus roars when a student is accepted, I think is so cute and very appropriate. The Pukwudgie is Hufflepuff, the heart, the healer, seems obvious to me, and the Thunderbird is Slytherin, and that one is a little bit more abstract, but I like that because I feel like, and this is something that I said in the article too, is that Slytherins, to readers, are the most defined by Harry's opinions of them and by prejudice in the wizarding world. You know, the Slytherins, the fact that they're cunning, the fact that they're ambitious, the fact that they're resourceful and have self-preservation and in a lot of ways are as loyal as Hufflepuffs and Gryffindors, they just choose their loyalties based on different circumstances. Doesn't mean that they choose evil necessarily, but it means that they think differently about it. They analyze it. They are self-preserving, that's not a word, but you know what I mean, in a different way, more analytical, again, like Ravenclaws. And so what I really love about the Thunderbird-Slytherin correlation is that Thunderbird is the soul, and it favors adventurers, and it was named by Isolde's son Chadwick, an intelligent but often temperamental boy. I feel like this is amazing. This sort of lets Slytherins be something beside the, oh, you're a Slytherin, you know, they as an adventurer, someone who plots new ground and seeks glory and betterment for themselves or their chosen cause. I feel like Slytherins, again, with their inner life, with their internalizing everything, and it is a very soul thing. Like, I feel like saying, oh, this is like, I like that idea, you know, I like rethinking about Slytherin a little bit.
Oh, yeah. And like thinking about them in a new way outside of Harry and his impression of Draco and his father, who are clearly Slytherins, and all Death Eaters seem to, you know, they're all from Slytherin. So it's like once you get past all of that and, you know, look at the people who have been in there for generations before Voldemort was a thing, I'm sure there's a ton of good people who were in Slytherin at one point. And so, yeah, looking at it in a new way now, seeing a different way to talk about the qualities that you've seen in Slytherins does give you a new way to kind of see the house as a whole, as opposed to just how they were defined in the post-Voldemort era.
Yeah, like this is how Slytherins could have been without the prejudice, you know, without Voldemort and Grindelwald and all these people sort of giving them a bad name, and without them feeling like they had to live up to that bad name as a group, you know. So I really enjoy that correlation, and I think it's something, again, there's overlaps to other houses. I think the Thunderbird Slytherin thing is the thing people have taken most issue with, because it's hard to get out of the Slytherins are evil mindset, but I think we should try, because it's
They're and not, also, like, so if it helps, like, we don't even have to take it, like, to, like, think about other characters in the books that have been Slytherins. You could even think of, like, if you have fandom friends and some of those friends identify as Slytherin, like, my best friend identifies as a Slytherin, like, and I wouldn't say she's evil, but if you look at other people around you and say, like, you know, somebody, like, really identifies as Slytherin, like, if you stop and think about, like, the reason that they feel like their traits amplify that house, it might make you, like, more open to the idea that in the book, not all Slytherins are bad. So,
But yeah,
real world examples, guys.
Again, it's like the thing about, like, people sort of insisting there's no correlation is really funny to me, because, like, you can always compare something. Like, you know, you can always, always compare something. Even when, like, if you looked at, like, the Allegiant houses, you could compare them to Hogwarts houses if you really wanted to, even though those houses are super weird. So like
they're like, you know, Hogwarts houses on steroids.
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty much. Yeah.
So I mean, it feels like it's a weird argument to make. Well, they're different, so you can't compare them. And it's like, but I just did, and it kind of works. So whatever. So you can find that on hypeable.com, and I would love to keep talking about it forever, but we do have to move on, and we are not going to move on very far, at least.
No, we aren't. We're going to move from Ilvermorny and all of that to Fantastic Beasts and a possible new trailer. Our always reliable Canadian Film Ratings Board recently added Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them trailer number 3 to their ratings database, and that always raises our eyebrows, makes us think a little bit, because that usually means that a trailer is imminent. And with all of this fun Pottermore Ilvermorny news, we kind of wondered whether something was going to be coming. It's supposedly going to be attached to the BFG, which debuts this weekend in theaters. So if you're planning on checking that one out, you may just find a little, you know, Harry Potter, J.K. Rowling treat for you before the movie. So I'm hoping to see the BFG this weekend. I'm supposed to. I'm crossing my fingers. So I'm really excited because I'm really geeked about Fantastic Beasts. I want to see more and find out how this whole thing's going to work. So,
cool. That'll be exciting to see. I really loved, you guys talked about it last week, but I really loved the recent featurette. I feel like that finally began to, oh my God. I feel like that finally got me a little bit excited.
That's good. That's what I said too. Merima still isn't sold, but I am like all on board.
Merima was super excited. What happened? I've been gone for a while.
We will address this,
Of course,
at the end of the show. But yeah, basically, you know, Merima is like legitimately a historian, and so it's kind of hard to get out of that mindset sometimes. And I can understand that, especially if like you have a specialty in something, which she does. So
yes, absolutely.
But we'll get to that later.
We will.
All right, so we're going to keep going with some more movie news for you guys. We have a new Star Trek trailer that debuted this week. And interestingly enough, it also acted as kind of a teaser for Rihanna's latest single, Sledgehammer. Now, Rihanna and Star Trek don't necessarily sound like two things that should go together. But as an artist, if you have not checked out Rihanna's latest album, I highly recommend doing so, because she's been doing a lot of really interesting things. And she's not necessarily the Rihanna that you used to know, perhaps. So I would highly recommend listening to that when you get a second. And definitely check out the single Sledgehammer, because when you listen to it, it's just like this beautiful flowing ballad that you'll hear towards the end of the latest trailer, which you can find on hypeable.com. And it really kind of fits very nicely as far as lyrics go with like the tone of the story. So it just worked out very nicely that it happened to be in there. And you can also listen to the full track over on, we have a link to the Spotify as well. It's embedded into the article as well. So if you want to check out the full song, you can do that as well. Director Justin Lin also tweeted about her track being in the new trailer. And he said, "It honored Star Trek Beyond, inspired Sledgehammer. So we wanted to showcase that in the trailer." And it was a nice little nod to her as well. But yeah, it fit really nicely, I think. And the trailer is great. There's some new stuff in there. I know a lot of people were a little upset that it did not feature the late Anton Yelchin, but you know, he was featured in previous trailers, and a lot of these things get cut before, you know, way, way before. So it kind of makes sense that maybe he wasn't in there this time. But I'm sure we'll see a lot of him in the movie when it comes out in July.
And moving from Star Trek to Star Wars, I always like when we get to do that. We have some interesting news about Rogue One, the Star Wars prequel-ish story coming up in December. Darth Vader, as has been much speculated, will be in Rogue One, but he will be used quote-unquote sparingly. Kathleen Kennedy spoke to Entertainment Weekly this past week and says, you know, they have to make sort of careful use of this character so they don't sort of oversaturate us with him. He's going to loom large at a key strategic moment. And we also learn that at this point, which is obviously before A New Hope, which is around the time that this group of rebels stole the plans for the first Death Star, Vader's reputation in the galaxy 19 years after the events of Revenge of the Sith, Darth Vader is kind of like a background player. He's described as the muscle of the Empire. We also learn that the rebels in the story won't be aware of Vader because he's not really... He's more of a legend than an everyday presence. And there's a feeling that there is a dark power in the Empire, but they don't really know anything specifically about Vader. So it's very interesting. It's going to be... I'm glad that they're including him. It would have been really weird if he wasn't in it. I love that James Earl Jones is coming back to reprise this role. He obviously played Vader in the original trilogy, one of the actors who played Vader in the original trilogy. This is just good news, and I'm glad they're not overusing him. I'm glad there's going to be focus on the new characters.
Yeah, we reported that he was coming back last episode, but we did not have the details of his return. And so I like this because it makes sense for the story that they're trying to tell. I think that it, like, as much fun as it would have been to see more of him, it just wouldn't have made sense to have him heavily featured. So I like the idea that he's there when he needs to be, and he's kind of like this looming presence off screen when he's needed. So yeah, I think this is great. And I love that James Earl Jones is still around and down to lend his voice to this character again.
Yeah, I can't imagine them making a movie in the time period that Rogue One is going to be taking place and leave him out entirely. But again, yeah, you don't want another part of the Darth Vader saga. Like, just little bits of him would be good. So I think, yeah, I think they're using him the right way. That's really cool.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Moving on from Rogue One to possibly one of the strangest movie announcement things I've ever read in my life. So in case you didn't know, Tetris, yes, the block game you played on computers as a child, is being adapted into a movie, but not just a movie. Kasanoff, I believe he's the producer behind the project, he wants to make it a trilogy because the story they've conceived is so big that it can't be held by one movie. I honestly was floored by this when I read it, and Karen kind of brought it to my attention. It was like, Kristen, you have to read this. But one of the things that he emphasizes and makes sure, he says, we're not going to have blocks with feet running around the movie. It's going to be sci-fi. I know. Well, when you think about a Tetris movie, like, there's not a whole lot. There's no, like, plot. It's not something you think, you know, of being able to be adapted to a movie. But he's, you know, he says it's going to be a sci-fi extravaganza with the central theme reflecting the main goal of the game, which is creating order out of chaos. He told Empire, I guarantee it's not what you think. No one has come remotely close to figuring out what we're doing with this. So it's just an interesting, you know, kind of presence looming out there. I can't wait to start seeing trailers for the Tetris movies. And who knows, maybe they'll end up being really great, but it's just a really crazy new concept, and we'll see how it goes from here.
It's going to be like a 12-year-old kid that needs to solve Tetris in order to save the world or something like that.
Right? Like, I don't know.
And every sequel henceforth is like a harder puzzle.
a little bit like Ender's Game, just a little...
Yeah, exactly. Like Ender's Game meets Ready Player One.
It's such a weird trend to make up these weird stories about games, but I guess the Lego movie is the reason why everyone's doing it. Because they're like, well, if that was so successful with a franchise that, you know, toys, but still the Trolls movie is doing it as well. Like, they just make up stories and use popular franchises to sell tickets, but... You do wonder with something like Tetris, as well as the Monopoly musical that was announced last week. You're like, but what is the idea here, and how can that ever be good? So I'll be following this with interest, but after the Pixels let down, I don't really have high hopes.
Right, and that's the funniest part too, because like you're talking about making movies out of things that don't make sense to make movies out of, and I get that it lends itself to more of a creative license if there's no actual, like, you know, tale to be told, but it is still a big gamble. But something about it is clearly catching the eye of Hollywood investors because they're all getting greenlit. So
It would be like making a movie about the Rubik's Cube, like,
that's coming up,
or like Solitaire,
right? Like, or Minesweeper. Like, these are things I cannot imagine, but who knows, if someone can come up with a story, like, I guess it could work.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm sure those are both in development somewhere, so...
Well, we're going to move into some TV news. We're going to kick things off with Gilmore Girls, everybody's favorite upcoming revival. In order to celebrate the impending, you know, release of Gilmore Girls, the revival, which has not been given a release date yet, Netflix wants to make sure that everybody is allowed to binge the show. So starting July 1st, seasons 1 through 7 are going to be available worldwide for everybody to watch. And they recruited Lauren Graham, who, of course, plays Lorelai Gilmore, to film this really cute little trailer announcing this wide release of the entire first part of the series. And she ends it with "Welcome to Stars Hollow, we talk fast," which I thought was really, really cute. So yeah, get ready to binge the show again if you saw it the first time and maybe it hasn't been in your country yet on Netflix, or to binge it for the first time. And we do want to remind you that if you're choosing to binge it for the first time, we are hashing through all of the seasons of Gilmore Girls here on Hype in our Gilmore Girls Hype specials. And you don't need to be caught up on the first part of the series to listen in, because each episode only contains spoilers for the season that we're talking about. So it's a fun way to kind of take your binging to the next level.
Yeah, and meanwhile, I'm just kind of waiting for Gilmore Girls to come back to me, because I can't watch it now. It's off my Netflix.
That's the funniest part. Aww. I can't, because I was telling Selena that it's still available on my Netflix in America, but for some reason they decided everybody else needed to, like, get the Gilmore Girls pulled so that they could re-release it again in, like, a few weeks.
I know.
Which, in a few days. It's July 1st. It's just, like, in 2 days.
Thank God, because, like, we have specials to plan, and I can't watch it, and I'm like, what do I do? So, yeah.
Yeah, and I need you to get on the Dave train since you're on season 3 now.
I don't even know who that is.
Dave.
So, yeah.
You know, this announcement was so funny, like, watching people who hadn't read the article get excited because they thought it was, like, a release date, because out of nowhere, this announcement just kind of popped up, and, like, people were like, yes, yes, oh my gosh, and then it was like, just kidding, it's available, the first 7 seasons are now available, you know, are going to be available on Netflix worldwide, and I'm like, oh, well, that Kristen. Wasn't the announcement we were hoping for.
But Kristen, this literally gave me a heart attack, because we've been procrastinating, like, the rest of our specials on here, because, you know, life gets in the way. And all of a sudden I see this come in at like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I'm like, oh no, there's no way. And then I watched it and I was like, okay. But I did notice that Netflix, like, through their official account on Twitter, they had to keep clarifying to people who thought that it was going to get released. So it wasn't, I guess, like, everybody was just hoping for something else. But this is still really cool, because it'll give fans a chance to get caught up again on the show, or for the first time.
Absolutely. All right, moving from one giant franchise to another, Game of Thrones, which just finished its fantastic season 6 run last Sunday. We found out that we've only got 2 more seasons, and neither of those seasons will be a full 10 episodes, so we're looking at about 15 more episodes left. It's kind of bittersweet, but Benioff was interviewed, and he said that they're kind of thinking about 73 hours as the total run for the entire series of Game of Thrones. They've always intended for it to be like a 70 to 75 hour story. And he kind of went on to talk about, like, where we're at now and where the finale ended and what it means for the story as a whole. And he's one of the more interesting things, as he said, the pieces are on the board now. Some of the pieces have been removed from the board, and we are now headed toward the end game. So while, some of those earlier seasons, it felt like a little bit more wandering than anything, like, you know, just like the books, they were trying to stay true to some of the book story. But now it feels like they're going to be hurtling, you know, full steam ahead to try and tie up all of the loose ends and get the rest of the story told. And they've got less than 2 full seasons worth to do it in. So I'm happy that, you know, it's good and bad news. Good news to know we've got 2 more seasons. Bad news that neither one of them is going to be a full 10 episodes. So, you know, Game of Thrones.
So sad. This is like, I just got into it again, and it's so good now. And to know that 15 is the very top, it seems impossible because it's so little.
Yeah. I mean, season 6 was stellar.
Yeah.
It was just amazing.
Like, it could have been longer. Like, I feel like they need to shorten episodes. Like, I obviously don't know the reason why they're doing it, but it just, I feel like 10 episodes was just enough because we need like time for filler stuff. I feel like that's the one thing with Game of Thrones, it never really lets you linger on the moments when they come, you know, the earned moments, like that moment with Tyrion and Dany in the throne room, for example, in the finale was like one of my favorite things, and that wouldn't have, they wouldn't have had time for that if they just had 6 episodes to tell the story of the season. That makes me sad.
Well, if you are looking to fill a Game of Thrones void in your heart, the good news is that AMC's brand new series Preacher is doing very well. So well, in fact, that they've been renewed for season 2, despite the fact that they're only 5 episodes into season 1. So that'll kind of give you a good idea as to how well they're doing in the ratings. The show's really, really good. If you guys haven't checked it out yet, I highly recommend doing so. It is based on the graphic novel by Garth Ennis and Steve Dillon, and it stars Dominic Cooper as a unconventional preacher who embarks on a journey to find God in a very strange and dark and twisted world here on Earth, along with his girlfriend Tulip, who's a bit of a gun for hire, and his Irish vagabond vampire Cassidy. So it's a really, really great show, and looks like it'll be sticking around for a while. Season 2 has had a 13 episode order put in, and it's set to premiere sometime in 2017, probably keeping that Sundays at 9 p.m. slot that it currently is at on AMC.
I still haven't watched it, but I'm glad it's getting renewed. I'm very excited to finally catch up with it.
I think you'll like it. It's very intriguing.
Karen watches it and quite enjoys it. I have not tuned in because she was like, Kristen, I don't know. She knows my like limits for things, especially like scary things. Mm-hmm. Like she made me watch Scream and I was scarred for life. But yeah, no, she was like, I'm not sure if this is your cup of tea. I might check it out just like one episode to see how it is, but we'll see.
Okay, yeah.
Well, Kristen, I'm a bit of a wet blanket as well, but I can deal with this. Similarly to how I can deal with The Walking Dead. So,
okay, good to know. I mean, I watch Walking Dead.
Yeah, not fine. That they're comparable, but it's still like, I don't know.
We'll see.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely.
But I've heard it's amazing. Yeah, what I have heard is that people who love the show, like, really like it. So that's awesome.
Surprise. People who love it really like it. Okay, so moving on now to some interesting news from the Oscars the Academy that has spurred up some controversy. Ah, I got it right. So the Academy has announced a quote-unquote diverse new Oscar voting class with 46% female and 41% people of color. So this is 683 people who were invited to join the class of 2016, which is the one, you know, the big Academy members are the ones that nominate and, you know the vote on the films that win awards, obviously. So what is interesting about this is that obviously on the surface this looks very diverse. You know, they come in and say, well, we added in this new class, which is 46% female, 41% people of color. First of all, what some people have begun by noting is that for the new class, they didn't even add half. Like, in an effort to diversify, obviously, they're adding a whole new class of people, adding, like, 100% women or 100% people of color. Like, that would have been good, but they've chosen not to do that, which is fair, but they haven't even made half. And obviously the question is also how many of these people are female women of color, which is obviously a group that is particularly underserved by Hollywood and the media in general. So when you look at the final numbers as well, you might be surprised to find that actually the 46% females in the new class actually only take the full number of full percentage of female members of the Academy from 25% to 27%. So it's a 2% increase there. And for people of color, it is only incrementally better. The 41% of the new class took the 8% membership number up to 11%, so a 3% increase there. So first of all, what do we think of this? Should we be clapping or should we say do better?
Well, I think that it's a small step towards a problem that is going to need to be better rectified over time.
Right.
But I think that because we know that members that are already in the academy are inducted for life and just the new members are going to be the ones that are going to have like a time limit set upon them from this point forward. Mm-hmm. That's what they announced earlier. You kind of have to wait for like those old people to die out before you can really start to see change. I mean, I hate to, it sounds so crass, but that's just the way it's gonna have to be, because if they're gonna like keep the lifetime membership for those older members, then there's no way that we're gonna see this even out for years and years and years to come. And that's like the sad truth, but this is a very small good start, I would say. Well, it's better than nothing, but it's not the best.
I feel like if these numbers had just scraped past 50%, you know what I mean? Like, it feels like they have to do so much to bring the diversity numbers up. And I'm not saying they necessarily had to add 100%, even though that would have been good to do to weigh up the numbers and make it more equal. But even if they were just going to add a segment, then at least make it slightly more than half. You know, like, it feels weird that they're coming out and being so self-congratulatory on this when they know that there's such an imbalance of members, like both women and people of color, and the new class isn't even 50-50.
Right. I think that they've got a long way to go before they can celebrate, but I think that people need to look at this realistically. Like, can they make a difference? And
don't you think if it had been either 50%, 50% women, men, and people of color and white people, or if it had been like 60-40, like, even though that wouldn't have required a lot, but I feel like people would have seen that as more of a sure sign than them trying to rectify the problem by actually adding less than half of the full number, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, I totally agree that they could have done better as the first step, but considering that they're, like, so archaic in like, their way of thinking, I think that it's so sad to say this, but any small step is better than no step, which is what they have been doing for the past couple of years.
Like, even though we can be mad, it's you're right to say that. I feel like looking at these numbers, I'm like, you couldn't even have made it 50-50.
Well, so here's the thing, and this is what really upsets me about the story. It's like if you only look at the headline and you only read, like, we've added, like, these bigger numbers, and you don't stop to break that down, that's where they're being a little bit seedy about it. It's not until you start reading, like, into the article where, like, we talk about how, like, it only brings it up, like, three, like, in the grand scheme of things, like 1%, 2%, 3%. That's when you realize that it's still a long way to go. So I think that the way that they kind of, like, masked this in a way to make it look like a bigger deal than it was is, like, you know, that's why they shouldn't be congratulating themselves. Because I don't know. It's just like, it's obviously never going to fix like the whole problem. And I say this too, like, this is kind of getting off a bit of a, like, on a bit of a tangent, but I talk to people about this in terms of like equalizing or like balancing out the winners, like the types of people that win best actor, best actress. Like, in order for it to be absolutely even, you would literally have to rig the system. Like, if you wanted it to be even by next year, like the number of like people of color that have won best actor versus, like, you know, other people, then you would literally just have to rig it until, like, you got those numbers. So if you want, like, you can do that if you want, or you can let it happen organically, which is, I think, what they're trying to do. There's really no right or wrong way to do this. It's like, people are going to be upset either way. So it's almost like you need to let history, like, fix the problem that has been going on historically. So.
Right. Well, and correct me if I'm wrong, if you know, I was under the impression that, like, winners from the previous year, a lot of times are inducted into the academy. Like, and since last year's class was so predominantly white, you're automatically dealing with a large portion of the new inductees are going to be white. But now that they're adding a whole bunch of, you know, of other races, and they're paying more attention, if this year's nominees reflect that, then you'll have more inductees that are more than just white folk. You know what I mean? Right. Like, so maybe next year the numbers will be better because some of the winners will be women of color, and that rather than just being, you know, straight white men.
Right. No, that's exactly what it is. And that is not to say, too, like, just, like, you could sit there and you could induct, like, you know, like, it, like all people of color, like make the academy completely balanced. But that doesn't necessarily mean that all of those people of color are going to vote for the person of color.
Exactly.
So
yeah.
We, you know, at the end of the day, it's like, I think that there's no way that they could completely like revamp the entire system overnight or over the course of a year. But I think the fact that like social campaigning has done enough to light the fire under their butts for them to actually like try and move forward and make some kind of a change is better than no kind of change.
Mm-hmm. You're right. You're right. I feel it's just weird to me because I know that this doesn't. I mean, I know this slightly ups the numbers, but it's just weird to me again because it's not even half the new class. Like, they added more men than they added women, and they added more white people than they added people of color for this class. So it's like, yeah. I understand the mm-hmm. math, but I still feel weird about it. Like, well, how is this trying to increase diversity when you add less than half of everyone you added?
And I just wonder if, like, they're trying to be like, well, I guess, like, they couldn't just... See, here's the thing. You would really have to get into the mindset of the person that, like, decided to do this.
Yeah.
Because for us, like, it doesn't make sense. But there has to be a reason why they said we can't just induct, like, all people of color. We can't just induct all women that are non-white ethnicities. Mm. You know what I mean? I don't know. It's just, it's so hard to, like, to infer what they were thinking when they picked these percentages. Mm-hmm. That's and the thing.
The thing is that it's not to say that, because there's a lot of people, regardless of gender and race, etc., that are being added that makes sense to add. So it's not like it, you know, even though I feel like adding 100%, let's just fix it now. But whatever, I see Pam's point. You know, there's Emma Watson was added this year, Tom Hiddleston, Brie Larson, Rachel McAdams, Kate Beckinsale, Patti LuPone. But again, I know it's a small thing, but I come back to, you couldn't at least have done half, you know, like half and half. I don't know. But anyway, a lot of interesting people are being added. John Boyega, Chadwick Boseman, Idris Elba, America Ferrera, Daniel Day-Kim. It's very cool. It's very exciting.
You know, the other thing is, too, is, like, I love that they're adding these younger stars.
Yeah.
These younger stars that are outspoken about the fact that there needs to be a change. And I think that if change starts from within, starting by adding people like America Ferrera and Emma Watson, even, like, you know, even though Emma Watson's white, like, they are outspoken about how important it is to equalize, like, women's, like, you know, women equalization with women's rights and like, you know, fighting for people of color and to be seen and heard and things like that. So I think it's they were very careful in who they chose. So that was kind of nice to see. And it's nice to have, like, these fresh young minds in there. And you can kind of only hope that they take voting seriously, because it's like, at the end of the day, if you, like, most people don't watch all of the movies, and that's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I mean, weird news, but okay, we can choose, Pam is choosing to see the good side, which is why we love her.
So I'm just choosing to see the practical side, I think, which is, like, I have no faith in the fact that they could ever dream to fix this over the course of a year.
Yeah.
But I think, like I said, any step is better than no step at all, so. Well, now that we're done with that depressing topic, here's some news that's either going to really excite One Direction fans or kind of break their hearts. Harry Styles, who, of course, is one of the four remaining members of the British boy band, has officially signed a solo artist deal with Columbia Records. Columbia Records is, of course, also home to One Direction, but this is a separate contract to what he has with the band. So it kind of looks as though he might be getting into, you know, potentially releasing his own solo album sometime in the future. Over the course of the past year, he has copywritten a couple of song names. So everybody kind of saw this coming, since he had already, you know, registered those. And if you want to check out those titles and kind of speculate what these could be about, they're over on the Hypeable article that Selena wrote up about this. So I think overall, though, because most 1D fans are desperate for new music from the boys, even if it's solo music, this is cause for excitement. He's kind of been a busy bee over the past couple of months that One Direction has chosen to go on hiatus. He's, of course, rumored to be in that Christopher Nolan World War II.
He's filmed it.
He's officially in it.
Yeah.
Oh, really? Okay. Originally, I just read he was in talks to sign on, and I never heard anything about it again.
Oh, no, the rumors were super strong when people saw him on set.
Oh, well, see, I missed that. I'm not the big One Direction fan that I thought I was. So there you go. You'll get to see him in the Christopher Nolan World War II drama, and he's rumored to be starring as Mick Jagger in an upcoming musical biopic on the Rolling Stones. So looks like he's kind of, you know, assessing all of his options and kind of going for everything now that he doesn't have a band to answer to. So there you go. There's your One Direction news for the week.
Yes. And that wraps up the news we have this week. Some news we did not talk about include, going off Tetris. Warner Brothers has set a Minecraft movie for 2019, so we have that to look forward to. Another thing to look forward to is Kellan Lutz could be starring in He-Man, Masters of the Universe, take that how you will. And finally, some good news. Hamilton has been filmed with the original cast on Tuesday. It's on its way to the Gringotts vault. So who has a dragon, guys? Let's do this. No news.
Where's Daenerys?
Yeah. Wait, what? So no news on when it's going to be released or anything like that. But at least it's filmed. It's set. We're okay. It'll happen eventually. Okay. So that's good. Good news. Moving on to TV show of the week. Let's start with Kristen. That's a fun choice.
So, guys, Big Brother has begun, and therefore summer of 2016 has actually begun. Summer begins with Big Brother for me. It truly, truly does. And it started last week, and live feeds went live last Thursday, and it's been an adventure so far. The first house guest gets voted out tomorrow, and it's the drama. I just miss it so much when it's not on. I'm a people watcher, like, to the extreme. I love, you know, just going and sitting somewhere in public and just, you know, being a fly on the wall and, like, watching. So Big Brother is fantastic because I get to do that from the privacy of my own home in my bed. Like, I can just turn it on and watch these people like a fishbowl, and it's really good fun. And the whole idea of the game, and it's good times. So yeah, Big Brother has begun. They had 4 returning house guests from previous seasons enter the house in addition to the 12 newbies. So it's an interesting dynamic this year. Most of the returning house guests are from the last like 4 or 5 seasons, so they're all pretty recent. So if you just got into Big Brother like last year or the year before, you'll recognize a couple of familiar faces. So if you haven't ever watched Big Brother before, give it a shot. It's kind of crazy, but it's a fun ride. So
Kristen, I'm just gonna tell you right now, if they do not vote out Jose tomorrow, I'm gonna like
he's
punch
going
something.
He's
I hope
going
so. I watched the show with my mom, and it is like the best guilty pleasure show around.
It's so much fun. Yeah.
And I don't watch it every summer, but every once in a while I tune in.
I've been a Survivor and Big Brother like loyal fan since the beginning. So yeah, it's so much fun. But yeah, Jose is going tomorrow. If he doesn't go tomorrow, I will be shocked and amazed. Just yeah. Keep that in mind if you check it out.
And Pam, what do you have?
Of course, Prison Break is coming back to Fox sometime this fall. And to get ready for that, and also for the fact that Prison Break's going to be at San Diego Comic-Con this summer, I started rewatching the show and rekindling my love for this series. I just came to the realization, I guess I had forgotten, which is terrible, that Michael Scofield is like legitimately one of my favorite television characters of all time. So if you have not seen Prison Break before, I will admit that it does get a little slow, especially season like 3, 4-ish, but seasons 1 and 2 are ridiculously solid, specifically season 1. It's amazing, and all the entire series is on Netflix. So if you want something fun to marathon, potentially to get ready for something else that's coming out, I highly recommend checking out Prison Break.
All right. And we're going to finish the segment off with Game of Thrones. It had its finale earlier this week. Are you all caught up? Are you fine?
Yes.
Yes.
Great. How exciting. So what did you guys think? Oh my God.
Oh my gosh. Oh, it was so good. So good.
It was so satisfying.
Yes.
Yes. I do want to say, I have to say, Merma obviously could not be here this week. She's in mourning for her girl. What's her name? I already forgot her. Marjorie. How quickly we forget. No,
quickly, To be fair, there were a lot of people that died. That's the biggest massacre I think we've ever seen
true,
on Game of Thrones.
That's true. I was very pissed off they killed both Marjorie and her brother in that way, Loras. I felt like, I don't know, I understand, I guess, but it just made me very sad. Like, I know Game of Thrones like to do this where they set up something and they completely just get rid of it. You thought something big was coming and it doesn't, but I would have, I don't know, I feel like it was she deserved a better death than that. And Loras, you know, I expect no outrage for the fact that Game of Thrones just killed another gay, and that makes, sorry, that's saying the expression, that's not being me being rude, but that makes me a little bit annoyed. Like, every time a show does this now, I'm like, where's the outrage? I wonder. Mm-hmm. So, but other than that, I thought it was amazing. I thought, you know, Sansa and Jon ruling the North is like the best thing in the world. You guys already know my thoughts on them.
Yeah, it's like, you know what's so funny? I feel like everybody feels the same way, but it's just such an uncomfortable idea to wrap your head around.
I know, but I
don't want to, but everybody's on the same boat. So.
I did the incest math on this, which is a sentence I never thought I'd say, which, you know, because obviously one of the reveals this week was something that book fans have known for years and years, but it was nice to have it finally confirmed that Jon Snow is obviously the son of Lyanna Stark and Rhaegar Targaryen, which makes him technically a Targaryen, which is going to be interesting. But it also, well, actually, do we know who his dad is? Did they confirm that, or did I just...
HBO kind of leaked it. Mm-hmm. I think they like put out this map of all of the characters and all of their relations, like how they're blood related who's married to who. And there was a connecting line from Jon to Rhaegar. So,
okay, so that makes sense.
They didn't say it in the show, but HBO has accidentally spoiled their own plot point.
Well, anyway, it's obvious.
That's amazing.
It's like the most obvious thing to anyone who's read the books or even maybe seen the show that there's something there. But anyway, what this means, no matter who his dad is that obviously Jon and Sansa are actually cousins. And considering, too, that they haven't... I mean, obviously they've grown up together, but they haven't actually grown up as brother and sister. You know, like they never considered each other brother and sister, for better or worse, when they were growing up. So I feel like, you know, you have that. And then... you have the fact that Dany and Jon would technically be like aunt and nephew, which is like more gross.
Which is so weirder,
like,
yeah.
Yeah, so like if we're okay with Jon Dany, surely we can be okay with Sansa Jon. Also because like in this world, and still today I learned to my horror, it's still okay to marry your cousin apparently. Which I
thought
like,
that it had to be further apart though.
No, no, like, the cousin is fair game. I was
oh,
like,
oh really?
Because
I like, I love how it's justifying this.
No,
it was second or third, not first. Oh,
it's,
wow.
You're allowed to marry cousins in some American states and in Europe, so...
Wow. I just really thought, like Kristen, that first cousins were still too close, that you had to go a little further down the family tree.
I thought so, too. I thought I was very surprised. But the point is that if, you know, some people were making the comparison, if Sansa had been set to marry Theon, no one would have thought that was weird. Like, because if they grew up together in the same same way that Jon and Sansa grew up together, right? So if they're just like, I'm not, you know, it's like a whole long thing to like basically justify myself, but I just feel like it's not as gross as people say it is. But of course now we're wondering if Sansa will end up betraying Jon, because she had that look at the end to Littlefinger when Jon got all the King in the North credit and she didn't get anything. I was expecting
Did you take that as, like, anger? I just took it as, like, see, Littlefinger, like, we don't need you. Like,
I know a lot of people did. I took it as anger. I don't know. There's mixed opinions on this.
I don't know.
I was going to say, the only other part of that we haven't talked about that I loved was Arya.
Oh, my God. Yes.
Oh, my God. First of all, Arya's back in Westeros. Like, it gave me such, like, oh, I love her so, so, so much. And, like, that huge... like bomb being dropped toward the end of the episode was just amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love it. I love that she's back in Westeros. I also love that Daenerys is finally coming to Westeros with Tyrion. Like, that just feels too good to be true.
Like, I can't wait to see the look on, like, Cersei and Jaime's faces when Dany just rolls into King's Landing with Tyrion, like, at her side. Like, what the hell? You killed Dad and this is where you ended up? Like,
he's just gonna be like, she made me Hand of the Queen. What if you guys made me? Nothing.
You guys have done nothing but treat me like crap. She's awesome.
Yeah.
Do that.
It's also interesting what's gonna happen to Jaime, because he didn't look happy about Cersei sitting on the Iron Throne. You know, all their kids are dead now. That was actually. I'm sorry. I have to note it. Anyone else laugh when Tom jumped out the window?
I had to rewind it because I was like, wait, am I seeing what I think I'm seeing?
Yeah, like, did he seriously just jump out the window? And yeah, he did. It also, you know, with all of the bad luck that we've had with Lannisters on the throne, like, it kind of makes me wonder if maybe, you know, there's not a little hope for Jaime and Brienne.
Oh my God.
Hanging out there, you know? Like, if Cersei dies, Jaime's gonna need someone to comfort him. And, you know, Brienne's still out there.
I know. And she's the Mad Queen now.
Yeah.
But it is funny, though, how Daenerys was all set on, like, being the first female ruler of Westeros, but now she's not.
Well, she'll
Cersei
be the first
can claim human. That. Yeah, it's true. But Cersei has been, you know, technically when she and Yara were talking in Meereen, she was like, you know, Westeros never had a female ruler, and now it does. So that's kind
of... Well, speaking of badass female rulers, can we just, like, give it up for Lyanna Mormont? Because, again, she just, like, slays life. Knows what she's doing more than, like, anybody twice her age, three times her age. She's awesome.
She's the best. She needs to get the throne in the end. Like, oh my God. That's fantastic.
Yeah, like, they need to find ways to just bring her into rooms next season. Like, I don't care how they do it. She just needs to be present all the time to lay the smackdown.
Yes. So we're going to wrap up today with listener feedback. We have some comments from Hypeable, we have emails, and we have tweets. So we have all the stuff today. And I actually want to start really quickly with Twitter today, because I want to start by reading off some of our listeners' Ilvermorny results, because I forgot to do that when we were talking about it in the news. So Pam and Kristen, do you guys just want to take these one at a time? There's four of them.
So Nicole says, always felt more connected with the quirky side of Ravenclaw. I was sorted into Pukwudgie, and I love that it represents the heart.
Yeah, I love that. It does. Aww. It does. It indicates some overlap too between those two houses. That is nice.
Yeah. Cassandra says, Horned Serpent. Though I answered one question by accident, and it didn't let me go back and redo. Awkward format. I haven't seen a whole lot of Horned Serpents either. Oh, I see the rest of it. Oh, sorry. She also says, if I asked a supernatural being a question, I would want to know beyond a shadow of a doubt what other options were. She said she's always been a Hufflepuff. So,
you know what's funny about this tweet? And I wanted to include it. Thank you so much for your tweet, Cassandra. I wanted to include what's funny about this is that you end up saying you've always been a Hufflepuff, but everything she said until now made me think she was a Ravenclaw. She was like, you know, very concerned with answering the questions right and wanting to know the details of it. I thought that was very funny. So maybe you have a little more Ravenclaw in you than you thought you did.
All right. @NerdyGeek77 says Pukwudgie, and I was also sorted into Hufflepuff as well.
And Cadma says, I'm a Horned Serpent and also Ravenclaw, so smart ass forever.
Nice. See, they connect. That's cool. So we have some other listener feedback. We have one comment for the episode last week by Colin on Hypeable.com, which says, Carmen Ejogo, an incredible actress of color, is portraying the president of the American Wizarding World in Fantastic Beasts. I thought that was worth mentioning, considering Merrimess expressed discomforts. Also, J.K. Rowling was absolutely torn apart for mentioning skinwalkers and Pottermore, but you wanted to tackle the struggle of African Americans in the 20s in a movie about magical creatures? So do you want to set up what this is in relation to, Pam?
Sure. So last week we were talking about the Fantastic Beasts featurette, which some of us were excited about and some of us were not. As I teased at the beginning of the show, I think it's very hard for Merrima to get into this because, like I said, she does, you know, professionally basically study history. She's getting her PhD in history. So it's very hard for her to kind of see this and not see, you know, some of the problems that come along with this, which is why she brought up the fact that she felt like it wasn't as diverse as it, New York, as far as we've seen it, does not look as diverse as it should have. It should look ideally if we're, you know, setting this story in the roaring 20s in New York. And so that is like a, I guess, like a factual error. But, you know, we see whitewashing happen a lot. We've talked a lot about whitewashing on here. I do apologize that we did not, mention that we do have a, you know, a woman of color portraying the president of the American Wizarding World in Fantastic Beasts. But at the same time, one actress of color, one person does not necessarily mean that the cast is suddenly diverse. That's the same as having like a token black man or like a token black, a gay guy or girl or lesbian or whatever. So that is all I have to say about that. With regards to the second part, I'm trying to figure out how to like explain what I want to say, but do you guys have any thoughts on this?
Well, I think what Merrima is referring to specifically is, first of all, there's no main players. Like, we don't know, maybe the Minister for Magic in America does end up being a main character, but it doesn't seem like she is. So you still have this sort of secondary, you know, you had a chance with this new story to shift the balance a little bit and you didn't really do that. It could have been better, I think, is basically what Merrima is trying to say. And it still doesn't mean that this isn't a good casting, but it doesn't mean that it couldn't and shouldn't have been better, especially considering past complaints there's been about the Harry Potter saga and the historical environment. As for the second part, I mean, I don't know. I can't speak for Merrima, but I don't think that because she had a story torn apart for appropriating Native American culture that she shouldn't include African Americans in her movie set in the 1920s New York. Like, I don't understand this question.
Like, I think
they're not correlated.
I think what Colin is trying to say is like, when how encouraging is it when you try to include and you do it, you know, clearly she didn't necessarily do her research with the Skinwalkers inclusion and it blew up in her face kind of a little bit. I think what he's trying to say is like, should, you know, it's hard to want to continue to include more and more diverse things when people yell at you when you try and you do it wrong. Not saying that's the right way to go about this, because we should keep trying. Like, getting it wrong is not good, but if nobody tries, then it's not going to get better. So we want people to get it right and to do the research and to, you know, and to represent everything accurately. But it just because she had one misstep doesn't mean that she shouldn't want to try better and keep trying to include more and more diverse characters in her stories.
I understand that sentiment. I agree with that. But I will just say, I think there's a big difference between making up these stories and taking Native American myths and including them in your backstory and actually representing reality. Like, this is the problem with the Native American appropriation was that she incorporated real culture into her fiction. I know this is still fiction, the movie is still fiction, but what she's basically telling us is to believe in a 1920s New York that sort of ignores these very present, very real issues that people faced at this time. So it does sort of seem like one is an appropriation and the other one is an a willful exclusion.
The other thing I did want to point out too is like when I believe, and it's hard to kind of, you know, speak for Merrima when she's not here, so we're trying the best we can. Hopefully we're answering your question here, because it is an important discussion to have. When she said that she wanted to see more of the inclusion of the struggles that the African American community was facing in the 1920s, I don't necessarily think that Merrima meant that J.K. Rowling needed to go into segregation and things that were happening in the real world. But when you look at Harry Potter, like the original Harry Potter books, there's no denying that like a lot of what was going going on with the hatred of Muggles and stuff on the side of Voldemort that very much correlated with like Nazi Germany and stuff like that. You can, like, this idea that nomads and wizards cannot ever mix. Mm-hmm, like incorporating this idea of a segregation between two different kinds of people into the story. And obviously, like, that correlates a lot with what was going on in real history in New York. It is a kind of a disservice to not see, you know, African-Americans represented when it was a nice opportunity for her, not necessarily to go into the history, but just to kind of hint at the fact that even though this is a story of fiction, it does mirror what was happening in the real world.
Exactly.
So those are just my two cents.
Exactly. And that's why we were so, like, happy. One of the many reasons we were so happy about Hermione's casting in Cursed Child is because it sort of does lend an element more and a stronger element to her character than that was sort of hinted at in the books, why she so strongly reacts to being segregated in the wizarding world. You know, we were like, wow, that's really nice that they sort of made this link, because it has been missing from the Harry Potter books, this connection. And that's, I feel like, even with the American Minister for Magic, who is black, which is fantastic, like, no one's saying it's not. I think Merrima makes, and Pam, by extension, makes a really, really good, important point, and I think it's sort of, it's bad form for us not to bring it up, because it's something that shouldn't go undiscussed. Just because we're fans of something, we can still sort of recognize the inherent sort of problems that it perpetuates by exclusion. All that said, though, we haven't seen the movie yet. So all of this is based on principal casting and featurettes. So everything we've seen so far basically has not made us very confident on this topic, but there is still the actual movie for us to hold out judgment for, you know? But
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, you can only infer so much as to what's going to be represented in the story from the stuff that comes before, but, you know, it's all we have to go on, so that's what we've gone on so far. But yeah, once the movie comes out, we'll have a better idea of exactly what she included and what she didn't, so.
Exactly. So we have two emails, and the first one from Fernanda, I just want to warn you guys, there's no spoilers, so don't be afraid. I wouldn't have put it in there. I know you see the words Cursed Child and you have that, but no. So Kristen, do you want to get that one?
Sure. Hi, guys. Just wanted to give you my input on the Cursed Child and exclusion within the Harry Potter fandom discussion from a developing country perspective. I hate to say it, but I don't really think the Harry Potter fandom is as inclusive as we may wish it was. Of course, one of the big messages of the books is unarguably inclusion, but reality is maybe a little less magical. There are literally hundreds of thousands, I don't know, maybe even millions, of Harry Potter fans that simply do not speak English. That by itself is an inevitable form of exclusion. Here in Brazil, we had to wait like 6 months for the books to be released in Portuguese. If I'm not mistaken, from Goblet of Fire on, we could buy the English version simultaneously with the rest of the world, but they were insanely expensive. I, for one, although did speak English, could not buy them, being a broke student at the time. So I had to wait for the Portuguese, cheaper versions. And, of course, there were people around me reading the English version. So I've had to deal with the to be or not to be spoiled dilemma before, just like now with Cursed Child. Of course, I agree it was easier back then when the internet wasn't so omnipresent in our lives, although I did get spoiled on Dumbledore's death, sorry. But still, what I'm trying to say is that I was kind of surprised and positively amazed by your reactions of unfamiliarity with this feeling. It just isn't something new for me, sadly. Lots of love, Fernanda.
I love this point. I think this is a really important point. And I just want to say, as a fellow non-native speaker, until I learned to speak English for myself, I had to wait for the books too. We still have to wait for movies, as I complain about a lot on here. Luckily for me, this area of the world speaks English very fluently, but there's a lot of people who don't, and there's a lot of people who don't feel like they get the same out of the stories when they are in a foreign language, so they, you know, they, and that is always going to be a problem with any medium. When you have something written in one language, you have to wait for it to be translated into another language, and we just see it more with English going out, because English is so dominant, you know. A lot of people who consume anime content, for example, they have to wait for it the other way around, because they have to wait for it to be dubbed or subtitled. So, I mean, this is a very good perspective, and I really love bringing this up. And I think, you know, it is sort of, it's an interesting thing to consider when talking about inclusivity and accessibility of something like Cursed Child, you know, because it's already so hard to wrap our head around as English-speaking Harry Potter fans that some of us know and some of us can't find out until July 31st, and some of us want to wait even longer because they're going to see the play live, and some of us are only going to get the script. If you add to that, oh yeah, and some of us don't even speak English, so we actually have to wait for a translation to come out. That just adds even more sort of scattering to the fandom, you know? But then again, you might say, if you don't speak English to the point where you can read the book in English, then maybe you don't engage with English-speaking social media.
That's a fair point. Yeah, I don't know how to answer that. But Fernanda, you should write back and let us know if you have any light to shed on that, because that's what I would be interested in too. Like, are these people just immune because they're, you know, not native English speakers, so they wouldn't necessarily be like looking at spoilers in the same way, even if they came across them? Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Yeah, because American culture and British culture is so accessible to us because we engage with it. It means something to us. We both, you know, politics and culture, we hear a lot about it here. But maybe if in a culture that is more, so you might get a slightly different media environment, you know? Anyway, it's an interesting discussion. Pam, do you want to read the comment from Shannon?
Sure. Shannon says, I'm finally almost caught up on the podcast. I'm really enjoying all of it. And I wanted to suggest Chuck for a Gilmore Girls style rewatch. It's an awesome show. And I would love an excuse to rewatch it again. Also, I love, love, love the interviews with Bradley and Alex. They both seem like such fun people to talk to. And oh my God. And Pam's spider story is probably the best celeb meet cute ever. Well, thank you, Shannon. I yes, appreciate that. Next up, Colin Morgan. You know you want to. Side note, we totally do. thanks for the excellent show. Looking forward to future episodes, Shannon. You're right, Selena. Cut that out. We need to play hard to get.
Yeah, exactly. Well, if they contact us first. No, I'm totally kidding. Thanks so much, Shannon, for that comment. We are working on more fun stuff for you guys in the future, so definitely watch this space. Wrapping up with a few more tweets here, and then we're out of here. So Shalumiel says, so because of Selena Wilkins' hype episode with Alex Lajos, I want to watch Versailles, but I can't. Hoo-hoo life. So there's another international problem. We have to wait for it to get on DVD. So I hope it comes out soon. Abby Lee says, I also played Mystery Date. That was my version as a kid with the boys and phone. Secret guilty pleasure. What's this about, guys?
So last episode, which you guys both missed, Kyle brought up the fact that Monopoly was being made into a Broadway musical. And then we got into the topic that Monopoly has also been greenlit to possibly make a, like, have a big screen adaptation made out of it. Mm-hmm. So then I joked that what I really want out of life is this Mystery Date board game thing that I used to play when I was younger. We put some pictures up on the Hype Twitter account, by the way, if you're curious. So maybe Kristen is familiar with this. It was like this board game, and there was this telephone, and you would like take turns answering it, and there was like a guy on the other line, and you had all these trading cards with like random boys on it. You had to guess which one was your secret admirer. And it was like, it's especially funny now because Chris Evans was a stock model for his game. Yep. So we found his old trading card and tossed that up too. There are two variations of this though. Like one, and we have them both up in this tweet that we released. But I love that, Kristen, you know about this because neither Kyle nor Marima had heard what I was talking about, and they thought I was completely crazy.
Oh, yeah, no, Mystery Date, there was a game my sister and I had called Perfect Match, and it was, like, kind of the same concept, but you had, like, these two little pieces that you fit them together, and if you had found your match, it would, like, sing a little song. It was, like, dee-dee-dee-dee-dee or whatever. But, yeah, no, those, like, Mystery Date, Perfect Match, all of that stuff, oh, yeah, that would be hysterical. Like, I could see that being a movie. Like, that would work better than Tetris, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's all in jest, but these days you never know.
You really do never know.
I don't know this game, but I remember making a comment about Monopoly that Clue would have made a much better musical. So maybe this is kind of along the same lines. Okay, so wrapping up with a final tweet from Jules Gamache. I totally took this from Rewatchable. I'm sorry. Kristen, don't tell the others. So Jules sent me an rewatchable question saying, what is the best Buffy outfit to cosplay? And then she sent, update, I got inspired, I'm going with this one. And it's a picture of Buffy with the black top and red leather pants. And I said to her, I have this really funny story to share, and I'm going to share it with you guys and not rewatchable, so suck it. Which is that this exact very outfit is actually something that I also once tried to pull off. This is so embarrassing. It's like 10 years ago.
This is amazing.
Which, when I was graduating from school, right, from like main school, so we'd gone there, there was ninth grade, we'd gone there for like 10 years or whatever, and we were all gonna dress up, and I was like, I'm gonna dress up as one of my personal heroes, because I was like, I'm ready, you know, I've got a flat stomach, I can do this. And I was like 16, I think 15 maybe. The choice was between Buffy or Max from Dark Angel. And to this day, I have regretted not going for Max from Dark Angel. Because then I could have dyed my hair black. What I did instead was I have brown hair. And for the first time in my life, for the final day of school, I attempted to try to bleach my hair. And I have seen that episode of Gilmore Girls where Elaine does it.
Oh no!
The yellow is exactly how mine turned out. It was ridiculous. I never knew that I had so much red in my face until the yellow brought it out.
It's because you didn't tone it.
Well, I was at home. My mom was helping me, and it was so bad. She was so bad at it that, like, not all of the hair was dyed. It was, like, only some of it.
That I think that you need to post this on any of our social media accounts.
I don't think I have any pictures.
Are there photos? Damn it.
I don't think I have any pictures. I think, oh my God. And then I had, because I wanted to get this outfit from Buffy, but I couldn't get like neither the pants or the shirt. So I ended up with this really weird outfit that was in no way related to Buffy at all. It was literally just pants and a top and yellow hair. And I had to go to my graduation, and I had to, like, go, we had this whole party afterwards, and I had to go, and I was, like, trying to hide my hair, and it got really gross, too, it got, like, really sticky and stuff, because I didn't get all the stuff out of it, and I was, like, trying to hide it behind a hat, and, like, oh my God, and people were just, like, no one said anything, but everyone was, like, looking at me, and I haven't dyed my hair since. So that's the story. So, Jewel, I know you have blonde hair to begin with, so you're already good, but beware. Don't try to pull this off unless you have the exact outfit, because no one will get it. And
well, so Selena, there's always Comic-Con in a couple weeks. You can redeem yourself.
No. I'm never going to cosplay again. I'm never going to dye my hair again. It scarred me for life.
But I do love that your mom was so supportive about this dream that you had. That's amazing.
I know.
Yeah.
And I think she still feels guilty for the part she played in that mess. So yeah, I did once, actually, since that time, I have dressed up like a basilisk with my best friend. We had a two-part basilisk costume that we made ourselves. So it's not like I never dress up, but...
I was going to say, that sounds amazing.
It was amazing. That was amazing. Yeah. So yeah, it's a fun story time to wrap up hype today. So I hope you enjoyed that, and I'm still hurting inside. So it helps to laugh. I'm sure eventually the scars will heal. So that's the end of hype for this week. We're back next week for 105. You can leave your comments, as always, to get them read on this podcast by emailing us, hype@hypeable.com. You can share your own disastrous cosplay stories if you feel so inclined. If you want me to feel less alone, Jewel, we expect an update on how your Buffy cosplaying goes. And you can find us on Twitter @HypableHype. You can find us on hypeable.com, which is hypable.com. And you can find us on Tumblr, hypepodcast.tumblr.com. Have a great week, everyone. Until next week, my name is Selena.
My name is Pamela.
And I'm Kristen.
Bye, guys.